and welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. I'm Naomi Fowler. Coming up later, protections and incentives for whistleblowers from a lawyer's perspective.
Prosecutors will tell you their number one enforcement tool that they use is whistleblowers. All it takes is one well-placed insider to bring the information to the government and show firsthand what was going on. And we need to see more and better whistleblower programs.
As we find so often, the United States is a complex mix of the worst and the best. In the case of whistleblowers, does it offer a model for effective systems and solutions? We'll have a very quick roundup of this month's news. Just as the CIA has concluded that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, and the Senate's considering legislation that would suspend weapons sales to Saudi Arabia, among other things, President Trump has issued a statement of support, claiming there's nothing definitive linking the Crown Prince to the killing. He also quotes the Saudis that the journalist was an enemy of the state. Among all the other strategic and political reasons why the United States is unlikely to take any action over all this is an interesting claim made a few years ago by Saudi billionaire Prince Al-Walid bin Talal that he rescued Donald Trump from bankruptcy twice. And in the UK, the United Nations Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, Philip Alston, has completed his visit there to assess the state of poverty and the implications for human rights. Just as his conclusions from his visit to the United States were attacked by high-profile politicians, and we interviewed Professor Alston on his US mission on the TaxCast in Edition 74 in February 2018, ministers in the UK have also rejected his findings. British Government Cabinet Minister Amber Rudd has condemned his report and what she called the political nature of his language. Here he is, summing up his impressions from the UK.
The fifth largest economy, one of the leading financial capitals in the world, contrasted with the fact that a fifth of the population, 14 million people, are living in poverty, and 1.5 million are destitute. What I found in my discussions with ministers is basically a state of denial. If a new minister was interested, if a new government was interested, the harshness, the worst aspects of a lot of these policies could be changed overnight and for very little money.
That's Philip Alston of the United Nations. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen from the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Okay, John, last month on the TaxCast, we talked about the influence of dark money on elections and on political processes. There's been lots of focus and concern, rightly, over Russian dark money, much less concern and awareness about US dark money. But in the end, what we're seeing is alliances of oligarchs, really, and there's such a convergence of interests between them which transcend all borders and nationality. And there's some really big news in the UK this month, which, as we know, is in absolute turmoil over the negotiations on Brexit and leaving the European Union. There's long been speculation over the origins of what was actually Britain's largest ever single political donation for the Leave.eu campaign, which was made via a person called Aaron Banks. So just one person, apparently, £8.4 million. I suppose that's around $10 million or probably a bit more than that. The allegation is that it wasn't his money, or not all of it anyway, and that it may have come from foreign sources. Mr. Banks is now the subject of a National Crime Agency investigation.
Well, so before we talk about the specifics of this particular story, let's remind listeners about some of the terms which have come into our vocabulary in recent years. Dark money, for example, first used in the United States in 2010 to describe undisclosed money, often routed via non-profit organizations associated with the radical right, and that money is used to influence elections and political processes, typically bypassing usual requirements to disclose the identity of the real donors. Now, what we've been noticing is that a large amount of funding has been going from one country to another, USA to United Kingdom, for example, more often than not using special purpose vehicles created in secrecy jurisdictions, and this is why it's of interest to Tax Justice Network. And because of this tax haven secrecy, it becomes really hard to trace the origins of the money and check on its legality. Let's remember that most campaign funding laws make it illegal for a political campaign to receive funding from a foreign source or entity. Now, another term that's come into our vocabulary recently is influence industry. This term is applied to a large sector of IT businesses, consultants, political strategists, and established online platforms like Google, Facebook, Twitter. And they acquire personal information from our phones, our laptops, and our tablets, and they provide that data to companies to digitally profile voters and then target them with specific content to push them in one political direction or another for influencing votes. And another couple of terms we've been hearing a lot about are oligarchs and plutocrats. You used the word oligarch yourself. Now, these two overlap, but they're not the same thing. Oligarchs, or oligarchy, refers to a system of rule or government by a small number of people, the dominant few, whilst plutocracy refers to a society ruled by people of great wealth. But plutocracy typically is a kind of very surreptitious and using wealth to gradually displace democracy. Now, these terms all come together in this particular story, because this is a story about dark money, the influence industry, and plutocrats, all combined in a toxic mix of political interference. Firstly, here in Britain, ahead of the Brexit referendum, which took place in June 2016, and then immediately afterwards in the Trump election campaign later that year. Now, what's emerged in the past month is that this character, Aaron Banks, who you referred to, the City of London-based person, claimed to have donated $8.4 million to the successful campaign to persuade voters to support Britain's leaving the European Union. Now, he's under criminal investigation by the UK's National Crime Agency because so far he has failed to provide a satisfactory explanation for the source of that money. Now, why is the National Crime Agency involved in this? Because other agencies, especially the Electoral Commission, which have been looking at the source of funding, haven't been able to satisfactorily identify the true source, and they don't have the capability to investigate money coming from offshore. Aaron Banks appears to have used offshore companies in the Isle of Man, as it happens. The Isle of Man is a British tax haven, and he's used these companies as a conduit for transferring the funds to the Leave campaign. What the National Crime Agency will want to establish is, did these funds come from genuinely offshore sources? In other words, is this illegal foreign funding of a domestic democratic campaign?
So it's an offshore story again. And the other thing that's happened this month is that an expert on disinformation, Dr. Emma Bryant, has discovered emails that show that content between the key Trump aide Steve Bannon of the far right and Aaron Banks and other Leave campaigners were working together through and involving common businesses like the now defunct Cambridge Analytica company, which harvested data on tens of millions of Facebook users and pushed all sorts of black ops political campaigns around the world, which is easier and easier to do with monopolies like Facebook at your fingertips if you've got the money for it. And foreign campaign contributions, as you say, obviously not allowed under British law, not allowed under US law. Dr. Bryant says that these emails that she's uncovered show that, quote, Banks was seeking foreign funding for Brexit from the very beginning, close quote. And that's because in these emails, apparently, Banks asked Cambridge Analytica to come up with a strategy for his Leave.eu campaign to raise funds in the United States months before the Brexit vote. Leave campaign funder Aaron Banks has always denied any claims that he used any Russian money for Brexit. No one's really asked him about US money. The point is that democracies are really just not set up to deal with and manage and protect populations from all these risk factors, are they?
Well, in short, the answer is no, they are not. They kind of assume that there'll be a degree of transparency. Look, these new revelations from Dr. Emma Bryant, and they're published, by the way, on the Open Democracy blog, in my opinion, they start to draw the various strings together to make some sense of this enormous story. At the heart of the story, as you say, is the company Cambridge Analytica, closely associated with prominent figures from the really radical right. Stephen Bannon is one of them, the former Trump campaign manager. Cambridge Analytica largely belongs to a hedge fund billionaire called Robert Mercer. He's the plutocrat in our story. Now, what Dr. Bryant has revealed through these emails, they date back to 2015, and they're between Stephen Bannon, who, by the way, was acting in his capacity there as vice president of Cambridge Analytica, and the leadership of the UK Leave campaign, Aaron Banks. The purpose of this email correspondence, as you say, was the Leave campaign's attempt to use the Cambridge Analytica's database and expertise in online digital targeting to identify and secure American funding to influence the Brexit vote in the UK. That appears to be the direction of this. If this is the case, then this is a truly toxic story of radical right-wingers in Britain and the United States working together to use possibly illegal foreign funding to influence a democratic process in the UK, with the very distinct possibility that some or part of this funding was routed via offshore secrecy jurisdictions to disguise its origin. Interestingly, earlier this month, the Oxford English Dictionary revealed that the winner of its annual award for Word of the Year for 2018 was the word toxic, which is increasingly being applied to the way that dark money and the influence industry, this toxic funding is poisoning democratic politics. The ultimate winner in this grim program of undermining democracy is the plutocrats. The plutocrats like Donald Trump, who are rapidly enforcing their grip over the institutes of the state. Measures are needed to push back against this dark money. There needs to be far greater transparency. There needs to be thorough investigation of where money is coming through. We now need to start seriously addressing the question of how can elections be funded without involving dark money and the extraordinary resources of plutocrats.
John Christensen at the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. Whistleblowers come in all shapes and sizes. There are bankers like Bradley Birkenfeld, who saved himself from further jail time by informing on his clients who he helped to dodge their taxes, and he collected a huge reward in the process. And then there are LuxLeaks whistleblowers Antoine Deltour and Raphael Allais, who, at great personal cost to themselves, exposed the Luxembourg government and accountancy firm PricewaterhouseCoopers for secret tax deals with multinational companies, depriving Europeans of billions in tax revenue. Whatever their motives or their circumstances, we need their information. That's the nature of the system that we've built ourselves. This month, on the TaxCast, we look at whistleblowers, encouraging them, protecting them, and even incentivizing them.
Il y a deux ans, presque jour pour jour, à 3h du matin, j'ai signé un accord transactionnel avec PricewaterhouseCoopers.
2 years ago, almost to the day, at 3 a.m. in the morning, I signed an agreement with PricewaterhouseCoopers after 9 hours of discussions. The agreement was my guarantee for anonymity and to avoid judicial proceedings in return for my silence.
La menace pour mes contraintes était de 10 millions d'euros et la saisie de ma maison.
If I opposed, the threat amounted to 10 million euros and the seizure of my house.
This is Raphael Allais speaking through an interpreter a few years ago. He's the lesser known of the two LuxLeaks whistleblowers who formerly worked for PricewaterhouseCoopers. That's because they bullied him into signing a gagging order, which he believed wrongly, as it turned out, meant that he couldn't speak out publicly about why he downloaded and passed to a journalist 16 corporate tax returns, which showed exactly how much companies had avoided paying in taxes by transferring their profits through Luxembourg. It was the basis of secret agreements between the Luxembourg tax authorities, multinational companies and PricewaterhouseCoopers. The LuxLeaks whistleblower case led to a public debate and European Union investigations into whether multinational tax deals elsewhere were breaking anti-competition rules.
L'optimisation fiscale, c'est légal.
PwC, audit firms, multinationals and even some journalists repeat endlessly, tax optimization is legal. We respect national and international laws. No, it is not legal. Together with my lawyers, we have already a list consisting of more than 8 arguments representing evidence that it is not legal. 8. I was thrown to the Luxembourgish court. This would be the beginning of a living hell for me. There were hearings with the Luxembourg's investigating magistrate, always having in mind this agreement preventing me from speaking.
Pression, chantage, isolement, secret d'état, manipulation.
Pressure, blackmailing, isolation, state secrets, manipulation, twists and turns. Now that's been my life the last 2 years.
While the journey for his co-whistleblower Antoine Deltour is over, in the sense that the Court of Appeal has fully recognised him as a whistleblower as defined by the European Court of Human Rights, Raphaël Allais' appeal is still in process. His experience has shown how the lack of protection, support and the right channels for whistleblowers in the European Union create serious, sometimes life and death problems.
After 20 years of doing this, I still am every day just amazed at the courage and fortitude of whistleblowers who face these dilemmas and make the decision that they will go ahead and blow the whistle.
This is lawyer Mary Inman of Constantine Cannon. She's based in London and specialises in representing whistleblowers from the UK, the European Union and worldwide under US whistleblower reward programmes.
Tax whistleblowers are some of the most important whistleblowers because I think it's very difficult, as the Panama Papers, Paradise Papers show you, to detect tax fraud. And so they play a really critical role. There's a lot of tax fraud that goes on in the area of transfer pricing. And that is something that I see a lot of because of the international angles for it, that corporations like to use and basically manipulate the transfer pricing rules in a way to understate their profits, which are actually being earned in the U.S., which has a much higher tax rate, and classify them as actions that are being taken in more tax advantageous jurisdictions like Ireland, Jersey, and other places. So that's a really great example of something that's just pretty sophisticated for the average HMRC or IRS auditor to tumble to that. You're not going to find that in the most obvious audits. So I believe the tax whistleblowers in particular are vital, and we need to see more and better tax whistleblower programs.
We've seen so many cases where whistleblowers have not known where to turn, they've made some mistakes that haven't helped their case later on, and have muddied the waters in a really unhelpful way. They didn't know what support to get from where. What would the ideal steps be from A, B, C, T? You know, if you were a whistleblower, what would the ideal be as far as you see it? Because you're dealing with whistleblowers all the time.
It's a great question. I do deal with whistleblowers all the time. I've been representing whistleblowers under the American programs for over 20 years, and I believe that the United States, the SEC program, Securities and Exchange Commission, Office of the Whistleblower, is as close to the gold standard as I have seen so far. And there are a number of reasons for that. Obviously, there's the reward element to it. But I think what is equally as important, which is something we do not see as a huge gaping hole in the IRS program, is that in addition to providing rewards, the legislation, the Dodd-Frank legislation, allows for very stringent protections against the retaliation of whistleblowers. And the SEC has been very aggressive in enforcing violations. And in fact, has gone, there are at least 9 enforcement actions they've taken that go after companies who've gotten very clever, who try and in their severance or separation agreements, but in language that chills whistleblowers from coming forward, that says, oh, if you want to be separated from the company and accept this golden parachute, you must do so by releasing all claims you have to receiving award under the program, things like that. Mm. So the
non-disclosure agreements and things like that.
Exactly. Mm. So that's a really important piece of it. But there are a couple of other ways that the SEC program distinguishes itself, and that is that they allow whistleblowers to be anonymous and hold their anonymity quite dearly. And that is another thing that is just obviously critical with blacklisting and the negative impacts on your career. So you can come and you may be anonymous, not just when an award is disclosed and as to the public, you can be anonymous to the SEC itself. So I have represented clients who the SEC will meet with but are known to the SEC as Mr. or Ms. ABC or XYZ. And that is just an added level of protection for people who work in an industry whose livelihood is impacted. It's not a perfect program. But it has a number of the earmarks of what makes for a successful program. And boy, we have 10 years of data now. The program's been in effect for 10 years. And the Office of the Whistleblower puts out an annual report to Congress. And you can see in the amount of fines that have been imposed against from LIBOR manipulation to FX rigging to insider trading and various stripes of accounting fraud have all been exposed largely as a result of whistleblowers. And so I would hazard to say that the SEC was sort of a backwater unknown agency until this program came into existence, and I think a lot of people would agree with me. So it's been an enormous success and one that has spawned copycat or follow-on litigation in Canada. It certainly has been considered in 2016 by the Financial Conduct Authority here in London. Australia has been toying with it in recent legislation, so it has become a model. I think there's still, you know, more that can be done, but it has a lot of advantages.
And there are some really different approaches between the UK and the United States towards whistleblowers, right? Talk me through that.
I would describe broadly the U.S. programs as being both proactive and reactive, whereas the U.K. whistleblower legislation is just reactive. The U.K. also has a program. It's just not advertised. HMRC has a program where it is discretionary that they may, in HMRC's discretion, decide to pay informants who bring them helpful information. In fact, there is a tip line, a tax fraud hotline, and there's data from HMRC, they're pretty tight-lipped about it, that does show the amount that they have paid out annually over a number of years. The amounts are very small. So it exists. I would say it is greatly underused, certainly when it's not publicized, and very few except experts like myself in the field know about this. I think it has a long way to go, but it's a start. So in terms of reactive, I mean it's sort of an after-the-fact protection. Both the U.S. and the U.K. will protect whistleblowers after they've blown the whistle for any adverse employment action, retaliation, failure to promote, firing that happens as a result of them blowing the whistle. So that's really important. Without having retaliation protections, no whistleblower is inclined to come forward. But it shouldn't stop there, because when whistleblowers decide that they want to blow the whistle, there's two things that they think about. They think about, will I have protection? And then they also think about, they want the issue they're bringing forward to be corrected. They want it to be addressed by the enforcement agency that can take action, can prosecute. And that's something that the UK program does not have. So in the United States, the kind of law that I practice is specializing in not whistleblowing as part of employment law, which is more in the reactive category, but whistleblowing as private enforcement, as part of civil enforcement. So the U.S. has statutes, starting with the False Claims Act, and then a lot of folks are more aware of the agency programs. The SEC has a whistleblower program, IRS, the CFTC, Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and now even the Department of Transportation have them. But the idea is that prosecutors in each of those entities, in those agencies, in the Department of Justice, want people to come forward with what is we consider to be inside information. People who work at the corporations that are working either directly on government contracts or are working at banks and institutions that are regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission and the IRS. So what a whistleblower brings to a prosecutor who is typically public prosecutors, government prosecutors around the world are underpaid, overworked, and have a myriad stack of cases on their desks. What kind of case are they going to pick when it's time to figure out how to expend their precious resources? It will inevitably be the one where a whistleblower has basically provided them the roadmap to the fraud. Because the alternative is auditing from the outside. So the government can audit from the outside all day long, but all it takes is one well-placed insider to bring the information to the government and show firsthand what was going on. What may appear like, data analysis from the outside as something that could be explained innocently, when the insider is able to tell you and turn over memos and explain meeting notes saying, no, this was a conscious business decision to evade taxes, a conscious business decision to commit securities fraud, accounting fraud in order to gain a business advantage, then that is something that makes a case for a prosecutor. So in the United States, prosecutors will tell you, a number of prosecutors, particularly at the DOJ, say it is their number one enforcement tool that they use is whistleblowers.
Right, so has a critical role. It's really interesting as well how far the arm of the US law can actually reach. I mean, for example, with the FIFA corruption, the United States isn't particularly big on football, right? Soccer. But in the end, it was US bodies that investigated and took action because the US banking system was used and US investors could be affected.
Absolutely. I think people are very familiar with the idea of the long arm, the long reach of the U.S. and North American laws. Let's talk about the SEC reach. Under the SEC whistleblower program, you do not need to be a U.S. citizen to be a whistleblower, but also you don't need to work for a U.S. corporation. You just have to establish a nexus to the United States, but that nexus can be quite remote. The nexus can be sufficient if you're working for a company that is a foreign company but is traded on one of the U.S. stock exchanges. And sometimes it's not even that you're traded on the NYSE or NASDAQ or in the commodities. It also is sufficient that there, if you're traded over the counter, if you satisfy a certain level of American depository receipts. So it can be household names here in the U.K., like the Royal Bank of Scotland, are traded on U.S. stock exchanges, and therefore accounting fraud happening here in the U.K. is something that the IRS is very interested in because it impacts U.S. investors.
The money question is an interesting one because, you know, if you had a sort of a trajectory of whistleblowers, I would probably put Bradley Birkenfeld at the lower end of the scale in terms of principle, and then I'd put people like Antoine Deltour at the LuxLeaks whistleblowing and Raphael Allais at the top end. And yet Bradley Birkenfeld got a lot of money, yet he was pretty much had to expose what he did, otherwise he was going to jail for an even longer time than he already had, being a Swiss banker himself. You know, how do you deal with that conundrum? I guess it comes down to the idea about awards versus rewards, and, you get down to some sticky areas here.
You can certainly think about it as sticky areas for sure. It certainly provokes a lot of public comment. In my 16 months since being here in the UK, I've absolutely noticed a large divide, cultural divide, between the idea of awards for British citizens. British people will typically respond when I talk about rewards. They say, oh, that's all fine, but, you know, we're British. We do this because it's the right thing to do. We don't need to do it because we get paid. But if I reframe the question and talk about it not as a reward, but more as a safety net or an insurance policy, and talk more about that aspect to it, then people become much more receptive. And in fact, we're seeing that in legislation that's currently in front of the European Union. The European Commission has an EU-wide directive that has basically a safety net attached to it that is a pool of funds. This has not been adopted yet, but it is sort of embracing this concept of there needs to be, call it what you will, an award, reward, safety net, but a pool of funds to help whistleblowers pay for lawyers, help whistleblowers with this fact that they may be unemployable for life. Sort of my answer here is that you don't have to accept these rewards, and it still has the same effect. You can give them back. You can give them to, and a lot of whistleblowers do. A lot of whistleblowers give a huge percentage of it, if not all of it, to charity. So there is that possibility. But it's nice to have the option, because whistleblowers come in all stripes, flavors, and shades of gray and, you know, moral righteousness all the way down to maybe having maligned motives. But there are ways to address it rather than basically saying no rewards at all and basically precluding yourself of this really vital information and vital resource.
Right, yeah, it just makes me think of Rudolf Elmer, who just won his latest court case after, I think, 14 years, has just won on the principle that Swiss branches of banks overseas in the Caymans and places like that are not subject to Swiss banking secrecy law, and he's won that, but he's got a bill of 350,000 Swiss francs. So there again is a, you know, quite a principled whistleblower who has ended up picking up the bill, and of course will never be employed in that area again. So
yeah, you raise a really important point there, which is an access to justice question. And another purpose of these awards is it to deal with the fact that many whistleblowers go into enormous amounts of debt. In the United States, it's fortunate. U.S. qualified lawyers who do this work do so on a contingency fee or success fee basis. So that makes it a lot easier for U.S. whistleblowers to get access to high-quality counsel to represent them in this area. But those counsels, such as law firms like myself, put in enormous investments. These cases can sometimes span, you know, 7 to 10 years. And when you, as the law firm, are fronting all the expenses for the experts and for depositions and for investigators and all of the things that we all know go with litigation, that can be many millions of dollars. And so it's not many law firms who can do that without the potential of a large reward. So it's important to think about that reward as not only funding the whistleblower, but I know it's not as popular, but it's certainly funding a high caliber group of lawyers to help do this as well. Without the lawyers, we wouldn't have the whistleblowers.
Right, right. And the European Union as a bloc has been fiddling around with this whistleblower stuff. And just when it looked like they were going to put forward some really, really quite good protective legislation, or it seemed better at least, you know, it kind of always pulled back or it gets watered down. Now we're having another go at it. What would you say about the state of play now with what the European Union is doing in terms of protection for whistleblowers? Because there have been some extreme cases of persecution of whistleblowers and journalists.
I think they're doing enormously well. It has been an enormous undertaking, largely led by the Greens, in terms of getting the legislation to the state that it's in so far. So I applaud them. I am optimistic about its chance for passing. It has a great person in Antoine Deltour as basically being one of the primary motivating factors for the legislation, that whistleblowers face so many obstacles. One obstacle that they have in the EU in particular is that so many people work cross countries. Antoine Deltour was French, working in Luxembourg, in France, where he would have been protected by whistleblower laws. He, in Luxembourg, is indicted and is, you know, just looking to be extradited to fill a criminal sentence. So I think that is born of this idea that for whistleblowing to succeed in Europe, it's vital that there be EU-wide protections. And that is certainly what the new legislation aims to do. So just having that on its own would be an enormous victory. You know, I would love to see more of an element of rewards and financial rewards than simply the safety net. I think it's too vulnerable to not being funded and not having a sufficient pool of money to encourage both the lawyers and the whistleblowers to come forward. But boy, it's a great first start. And the other thing that's very interesting is it is requiring each member state, should it be adopted, needs to put in place an office of the whistleblower, which is this other idea that UK is flirting with as well, which is that, you know, whistleblowers need to have clear chains of communication, sort of like the emergency lights in an airplane, to direct you in the case of emergency to the proper reporting channel. And an office of the whistleblower, or a house of the whistleblower as they have in Netherlands, sounds more inviting, is a great first step. There are a lot of very innovative, important ideas in that legislation, and I have fingers and toes crossed that folks will see the wisdom of having it passed.
I've been speaking to lawyer Mary Inman of Constantine Cannon. That's it for now. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.